Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the Calcio Land Podcast of the Week. And today we are going to be joined at the end of the podcast with our great friend Andrew Barker for the first part of a two-part interview. Today we are going to focus on Inter. We, of course, have, since it's the Thursday show, our game predictions from Thousand Names and yours truly. And then we, of course, have the great Twitter questions from our listeners. But before we get to that, I am joined by our great friend, the producer of the podcast, our co-host, who is rightfully getting more and more space on the podcast, Alex Goldberg. And people have asked us to be a little bit more conversational as opposed to cut and dry question answer. So, Alex, I figure today we chat about who the best midfielders are in Serie A. I wrote about this on Sunday. I left it pretty open-ended, so I wanted to chat about this with you. So let's start with the old guard. We've talked a lot about Marek Hamšík on the podcast. We are waiting for Nainggolan's debut on Inter. So let me ask you, do you still rate them as elite midfielders in Serie A?
Elite, no. I hold that word in high regard. Elite to me is world class, top of the class, whatever you want to say. Elite, no. But I still see them as above average midfielders, game changers potentially every week, and they still should definitely themselves be some of the better players on their respective teams. Now, two seasons ago, David, for both of them, I regarded them as elite midfielders. But last year, they both took steps down. Honestly, we've talked a lot about how Nainggolan had an off year last year, and he did. Yet, I still think he had a better year than Hamšík. So, if anything, Nainggolan is closer to the elite category. But there's been a lot of inactivity right now with Raja in terms of didn't have a great year last year, and then he doesn't go to the World Cup, and then, as you said, he hasn't played yet for Inter. So I'm kind of in wait and see mode with Nainggolan, but I hate to be a prisoner of the moment for Hamšík, two games in for Napoli and not a great year last year. I'm a little bit more down on Hamšík than I am on Nainggolan, but I would still probably, if we're doing tiers, David, I would still probably put them in the same tier. If you want to say elite midfielders are tier one, especially within Serie A, I'm going to put these guys in tier two. Hamšík's 31, Nainggolan's 30, but we've talked about it. Nainggolan might as well be 34 because of the lifestyle he leads. So close, but no, they are not in the elite conversation for me. So, David, that's my take. What about you?
Yeah, I'm with you with that. Like with Hamšík, you know, I don't want to be so down on him, but we talked about it on Monday too. I thought it was pretty significant that Napoli was really open to selling him in the summer. Nainggolan, I need to see him play. He hasn't played in the first two matches. I'm not sure now that people expect him to be the savior, if this is good or bad for him. But between the two, I'm with you. I'll take Nainggolan over him, especially because he's going to be coached by Spalletti. Now, when it comes to Hamšík, I'll tell you, you know, when I'm trying to think who the best midfielders are in Serie A, I'm not even sure he's in the conversation for the best midfielder on Napoli. You know, I really like Allan, who I think is tremendous, and that match against Milan was really the best Allan commercial you could have. We had Zielinski, who of course had a brilliant match. He's been compared to De Bruyne. And we saw how much Napoli changed when Diarra came on to the pitch playing in that Hamšík role. So as much as I respect Hamšík's amazing career, as much as I respect the fact that he stayed at Napoli the whole time, I'd start those three guys over him. And then we also have the wild card of Fabian Ruiz, who arrived very highly rated, and but you know, let's see what he does in Serie A. So let me ask you, Alex, of the three Napoli midfielders that we do know, because we've seen them in Serie A, Allan, Zielinski, and Diarra, which one of the three would you rate as the best?
Allan, definitely Allan. For me, he's just, I want to make a FIFA comparison here. FIFA gives out, and the video game I'm talking about, FIFA gives out these tags, and they're not on Ultimate Team or maybe some of the modes that a lot of people play, but they're on the player profiles. If you click over to traits or characteristics or something like that, every once in a while they'll say acrobat or he's got a flair tag, and there's this very, very prestigious one that they give out. They don't give it out to everybody. They always write, well, they don't always write, but for the really elite players, they'll sometimes write complete midfielder, complete forward, and I can really count on one hand how many I can remember having those tags. But I wouldn't say Alan is really a complete midfielder, but he's close. And I know that sounds ridiculous because he's not really talked about in terms of the great midfielders of this current moment. But right now, you can argue he is the best midfielder on one of the better teams in the last couple years, and that's Napoli. Now, I know someone could say, well, Napoli didn't win anything, but still, Napoli was one of the better teams in Europe last year, and in my opinion, he was their best midfielder with Jorginho. But in terms of what he can do, David, he's even more complete than Jorginho, and I love Jorginho, don't get me wrong. If Jorginho was still on Napoli, it would be harder for me to decide this, but Alan can do a little bit of everything. I said in the last episode, you've made the parallel to N'Golo Kanté many times before. Even though I do say N'Golo Kanté is a greater player, I think Alan is a little bit more complete. I think he can do a little bit more attacking-wise, and he is no slouch defensively. And honestly, I know this wasn't specifically your question, but I'm not even sure I'm saying Hamsik second because I really like the trajectory which Zielinski has, but this was a no-brainer for me. I am definitely saying Alan is the best midfielder on Napoli right now. So, David, I want to ask you, though, while we're talking midfielders, how do you rate Miralem Pjanic now? And also, how do you rate Roma's new-look midfield?
So, I have to say, I never was a huge Pjanic guy until last season. He really impressed me. I think Allegri kind of put him a little bit more in that Pirlo role, and I really liked what I've seen from him. I think Juve absolutely couldn't lose him this summer because he's really the only creative midfielder they have. So I have to say I've rated Pjanic higher this year than I would have last year based on what I saw. As far as Roma, I mean, we look at a lot of turnover there. And, you know, since we recorded the podcast, the Strootman sale is official. He's gone. They lost Nainggolan as well. But I really like what they've done because I think in Zonzi and Pastore, had that great goal. We don't want to overreact to that. But if you ask me, you know, would you rather have the current versions of Strootman and N'Golan, or would you rather have Nzonzi and Pastore? I think at best it's a wash, but maybe I'd rather have those two. So I need to see Nzonzi to see what he can do in Serie A. But I could see him, you know, eventually getting in the conversation. He played really well in the second half. I know, Alex, you follow a lot of French football. You have affinity for them. How do you think Nzonzi is going to do in Serie A?
Really well. Really well. I think he's actually a player that profiles quite well within Serie A. He's a very solid midfielder. I still kind of talk about him a couple years ago at Sevilla having one of the more underrated seasons anybody had in Europe, and he's still not even that old either. I think he's a very solid midfielder. You know, because he plays for the French national team, he doesn't really get any shine there either because they just have some truly otherworldly type players. I think actually Steven Nzonzi has been one of the more underrated midfielders for a handful of years now. And once again, I think he profiles really well in Serie A in terms of the pace of play. I don't think he'll at all be having a hard time adapting to the league. I think that was a great, great acquisition for Roma. I really do.
So interesting to hear your take because I'm not that familiar with Nzonzi, not nearly as much as you, but he definitely fits a big need at Roma. So now let's talk about a player who, since our pilot episode, has been one of our protagonists of the podcast, Milinkovic-Savic. And look, you know, he's definitely not, there's not good momentum for him between the World Cup, slow start to the season. But do you still see him as in the conversation as being one of the top three midfielders in Italy?
Yes, because he is the most talented midfielder in Italy right now, and I 100% stand by saying that. Maybe he's not the most in form right now. People will talk about the World Cup, which I obviously think was a little overblown. He was not great by any means, but he wasn't as bad as some people said. And then, yes, as you said, he has not started off this season with Lazio very well. But then again, it's been two games. He is 23 years old, and he is really damn good. I stand by saying that you put fees past it and money past it. There's not a manager in the world, I think, that's going to turn down the opportunity to have Milinkovic-Savic in their midfield. I think many people this summer, once Milinkovic-Savic, maybe the rumors started to cool down about where he might go, they thought, ah, see, he was exposed at the World Cup. People won't want to pay that price. We've talked about so much on this show about how you really can't read in necessarily to transfer fees or whatever the team is asking for. I'm looking at the player himself, David, and Milinkovic-Savic is absolutely a top three midfielder in Serie A, at least for me. So, David, I want to ask you to kind of wrap up this discussion on these midfielders. Who are your top three midfielders in Serie A?
So I really liked your take on Allan. He's definitely, like, I've really liked him for a while, dating back to Udinese. I think last season he took another step. I think Ancelotti could really help him even more. So right now I have him in the conversation. I have him in the top three. Now, I will say I think both Zielinski and Diarra might have more upside than him. Would it surprise me if in 2 years they are better players than peak Allan? Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, if I had to bet where at least one of those two gets there, I would take that bet. But right now, I'm going to put Allan. I'm going to elevate Pjanic to the top three, and I'm going to stick to my guns with Milinkovic-Savic being in the top three. So those are kind of our takes on that. I'm always curious to hear our listeners what they have to say. So please tweet us in who your top three are.
All right, David, the next segment we love doing on Thursdays when the Serie A season is in full swing, and it certainly is. We have 2 weeks behind us now. Let's get to our game predictions with you and Thousand Names, and also, if you can update us on last week, that would be great as well.
So last week, so I have it for the season. I am 3-3. Thousand Names is 2-4. Last week, we both went 2-1. We didn't get off to the best of starts in week one, but I feel like I'm gaining my momentum now. I'm starting to feel like I have better feel for the league. So as usual, Thousand Names sends me three games. I'm going to read them both in English and Italian. We have a lot of listeners in Italy that want to tune in to see what Thousand Names is up to. And then I'll also make my picks. So the first match that Thousand Name pick, we're recording this on Thursday. This game is going to take place tomorrow. And this is Roma traveling to San Siro to play against Milan. So Thousand Names has it as 1-1, goals by Caldara and De Rossi. And he says, also today, Milan's going to win tomorrow. This is kind of a catchphrase you hear a lot in Italy. In Italian, it would read, of anche oggi Milan vince domani. And Thousand Name also says that Leonardo has built a ridiculous team, but not in a positive sense, and that he could see Gattuso getting fired, and that because of Milan's incompetence, Di Francesco is going to steal another point. So in Italian, Milan-Roma 1-1, Caldara De Rossi, anche oggi Milan vince domani, Leonardo ha costruito una squadra ridicola, Gattuso verso l'esonero, Di Francesco ruba un altro punto. I'm going to agree with him that it's going to be a draw. I think Milan played pretty well against Napoli for the first 55 minutes. I think, you know, they didn't play. The first match was because of the tragedy in Genova. They didn't have a game under their belt. I think they're going to be better. Roma played on Monday, so Milan had an extra day's rest. I'm not sure how much that matters at this point of the season, but I have it as a draw, but I have it as 2-2. The next match that Thousand Names picked, it's on Saturday. Juve traveling to Parma. Parma's finally back in Serie A. He has Juve winning 2-0, goals by Emre Can and Dybala. And the comment is that Ronaldo's going to miss a penalty kick. He had predicted this last week as well. There wasn't a penalty kick to miss. And he says this is another embarrassing performance by the Portuguese player and that he is the bust of the century, but that Juve is going to be bailed out by a Modgy-style refereeing of the match. And Modgy has actually been in the headlines this week because he gave a long interview to Corriere dello Sport. So in Italian, Parma, Juve 0-2, Sean Dybala, Ronaldo sbaglia rigore, ennesima prestazione imbarazzante del portoghese, il bidone del secolo, arbitraggio stile Modgy. I'm going to agree. I have Juve winning. I actually have them winning 3-0. I think Parma has to get their legs in Serie A. I think Juve had a pretty good performance against Lazio. They'll build on that since 1,000 picked Dybala to score. I know there's been a lot of speculation that he'll leave Juve. Did a little research on this. Not surprisingly, there doesn't seem to be any traction on that. And the final match that Thousand Name picked is Napoli traveling to Genova to play Sampdoria. This is on Sunday. This is going to be the ESPN game with our friend Matteo Bonetti calling the match. Thousand Names has Napoli winning 2-1 on the road. Goal by Quagliarella, who is from Napoli, and a brace from Milik. And he says that the Polish striker is going to make people forget about Higuain and he's going to destroy Ronaldo. He says that Ancelotti is better than Sarri and that Napoli are already on their way to the Scudetto. So in Italian, Samp Napoli 1-2, Quagliarella Milik, il Polacco, doppietta Milik, il Polacco fa dimenticare Higuain e distrugge Ronaldo, Ancelotti meglio di Sarri, Napoli verso lo Scudetto. I actually disagree on this. I have it as a draw. I know a lot of people think I'm soured on Napoli. I've been very impressed with them, but Sampdoria is a very good home team. Last season, they were one of the best home teams in all of Serie A. They beat Juve. They beat a lot of the top teams. I think it's going to be a draw. I have it as 1-1. So to recap, Thousand Names and I agree, draw Milan-Roma. We both have Juve beating Parma. He has Napoli winning, and I have Samp Napoli as a draw. So let's see what happens. We'll recap on Monday the results. So now let's get to our favorite part of the segment, and these are the fantastic Twitter questions that we get from our listeners. As always, you can send them in using the CalcioLand hashtag. The transfer window's closing basically in all of Europe tomorrow, so from now on, just send them on Serie A, TV, music, journalism, writing, things of that nature. So, Alex, which ones are we going to go over today?
All right, David, let's start talking about someone that we already have talked about this episode. Is Milinkovic-Savic a big game flopper?
Yeah, so, I mean, we've talked a lot about him already. I just think there's a lot of too much negative momentum against him. Last season, he actually had two very strong performances against Juve. He's played very well when going at San Siro, so to me, I don't see this at all. I just think, though, he needs to turn it around pretty quickly. Lazio has a big game against Frosinone that they have to win. I think, too, Milinkovic-Savic has to shake off this thing, that this theory that he's not playing well because he didn't get his transfer move. I just don't buy into that. I'm expecting him to get back on track, but so far he's definitely not shown to be a big game flopper.
All right, David, next Twitter question. How much time will be given to Spalletti at Inter?
I think a long time. I mean, for one, he signed the contract extension not long ago, last season. I think things went really well for Inter. I just think he's an integral part of the project. The potential candidates that would make sense to replace him, Conte and Mourinho. I mean, Conte is going to be in litigation with Chelsea over his contract. Mourinho's still the manager at Manchester United. I'm not sure if there's a very logical person. So I'd be really shocked. I don't want to overreact in Inter's first two games. But let's say it goes south and they struggle. I definitely think he's going to be given multiple months before he's really on the hot seat.
All right, David, how about this question? Do you see Keita Balde becoming a starter at Inter? And who would he replace in the starting 11?
So of the players we've seen so far, I definitely see him potentially replacing Politano in the starting lineup. It's also going to be very interesting to see where Spalletti is going to play Nainggolan. I think, you know, Spalletti is pretty versatile with formations. I definitely think there is a world where both Nainggolan and Keita Balde are starting. I'm just not sure in what order we'll see it, but I think Keita Balde's come off the bench both matches, did pretty well. I think we will see him sooner rather than later in the starting lineup, with Politano being the guy that loses the spot.
All right, David, how about this Twitter question? Do you think Milan will have a new stadium?
Actually, I don't think there's any momentum for Milan having the new stadium. I know this is brought up a lot every time there's new ownership, and now with the Elliott Fund, that is always one of the talking points that is brought up, a potential way to grow. But they're doing a pretty significant renovation of San Siro. Anyone that's been there, it's definitely overdue. It looks great on TV, but behind the scenes, it's not so great. And to me, the fact that they are making a big renovation of San Siro, which is going to be done in the next 2 years, although in Italy that might take longer, I just don't see that happening. In general, we see how hard it is to build stadiums in Italy. Look at Roma. So I don't even think we're going to go that rabbit hole anytime soon. My guess is Milan and Inter are going to be at San Siro for the foreseeable future.
All right, David, how about this question? How long will Borriello last at Ibiza?
So interesting wording on this. Borriello is quite the party animal. I don't think there is any better place for him to end his career than Ibiza. For those that aren't familiar with Ibiza, it's like the party island in Europe and Spain. Until the signing, I didn't even know they had a team. They are in the third division in Spain. Borriello's always been quite the playboy. So I think this is actually perfect. When we tweeted about it on Di Marzio's site, a lot of people were like, oh, this won't last. They'll be back in Serie A and whatnot. But no, I actually think this is legit. For one, last season, Borriello really wasn't much of a factor at Spal. And as part of the deal with Ibiza, he's getting an ownership stake in the club. I think he's getting about 5% of it. He can bring in sponsors. So I think this is really a lifestyle choice for him. And I think this makes a lot of sense for him once his playing days are over, which, you know, kind of in a way they essentially are. But really, what a perfect ending for a player. I really can't imagine a more appropriate team for him to hang his boots at.
All right, David, I really enjoy this next question. We're kind of moving away from football here. You've tweeted about this a lot this week. What is your take on Mike Francesa's app?
So I have a lot of thoughts on this. So before I kind of go into a philosophical discussion on this, long and short of it, if you like Mike Francesa, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, he is the sports radio here in the U.S. is a pretty big genre of radio stations that just have sports all the time. Alex and I got to know each other through a show on the local station here in Boston. But Mike Francesa, it's an institution in New York. So long and short of it, if you really like Mike Francesa, if you find him amusing, you find his show entertaining and informative, you're going to love the app. I think it's really more for hardcore fans than anything else, but there's going to be a lot of cool stuff going on down the road on the app that might even interest some of our listeners, and I'll just leave it at that. But this whole thing of the Mike Francesa app really made me think about where we are going with content and people paying for things or whatnot. And just this question really made me go down a rabbit hole of what the deal is with content. Should people have to pay for it or not? And, you know, I'm a big believer that if someone puts in a lot of effort into something, and you and I, Alex, work a lot on this podcast, you know, I even think on Di Marzio's site, you know, a lot of people tweet really fast whatever Di Marzio said from the TV show. People translate it really fast. That obviously takes away hits from the website. And, you know, part of me says, hey, you know, Di Marzio does this great reporting. He should be compensated for it. And look, he's already compensated it from the TV. But we're really moving in an era where things move so fast and there's so much free content that it's becoming really hard for people to make money off their work. So I have to say, you know, and Francesa's charging, I think, $9 a month for his app, which I have. For me, it was no questions asked. I'm a huge fan. And to me, it's like, you know, I know he's paid well at WFAN, but he's giving this extra content. I have no problem paying for it. So to me, it's a really interesting philosophical question. Like last night, I was having dinner with one of the admins on Roma's brilliant English site, and we were talking a lot about this. And, you know, they obviously give out all their stuff for free, but they're really building the brand for Roma with that. So I always find it very interesting. You know, I'm even thinking of you, Alex. You make like fantastic videos, but the way things are, I mean, it's very hard for you to find a way to be compensated for it. And I think Francesa's come up with this idea saying, okay, I'm going to give all this content. You want to hear me? You're going to have to do it on the app. You can hear me on the radio show, but I'll also give you this extra for premium content. And you'll have to pay for this. And he's been mocked, made fun of this. But I have to say, the more I think about it, it's really not the worst idea in the world. I was actually reading this article in the New Yorker magazine on Stephen A. Smith. For those of you in the U.S. or who follow American sports, I'm sure you know who he is. And he was talking a lot about this, how, you know, there was a time where people tuned into TV and whatnot to get news because you really didn't know what was going on. You would tune in and watch it there to find out what was happening in the world. And now we just don't live in a world like that anymore because you can get the news anywhere on your phone. And now it's transitioning that people are going on TV or different platforms to get people's takes on a subject. And Stephen A. Smith made a really good point. He goes, ultimately, most people think they're right. They don't really want to care about another's opinion. But there are some people that they respect so much that they want to hear what someone has to say on that. So I'm really starting to think that maybe Mike Francesa's idea of charging people to hear what he has to say, he puts a lot of work into it, isn't the worst idea in the world. So Horace, sorry if I digressed a little bit about that, but that's a topic that's really interesting to me.
All right, no problem, David. Let's now move away from sports entirely. Next Twitter question, which rock bands have the best logos?
And here's another question that made me go down a huge rabbit hole. I had to do some research on this. So I did a bunch of Google searches to come up with a lot of them that stand out to me. So I'll talk about, have them in different categories, and then I'll tell you which ones are my favorite. I was surprised by how many punk bands have amazing logos. The Ramones have one of the most iconic logos in rock, a lot of hipster t-shirts with that. We also have the person that sent in the question said that his favorite logo was from the band Black Flag, where Henry Rollins used to be the singer. It's a really cool logo. Also, the Misfits, a band from a long time ago, have another very iconic logo. I'm not a big punk rock fan, but I really do like the Sex Pistols, and they have a really cool logo. I really like the font. You know how you watch like movies about serial killers that send in stuff at newspapers and they cut out letters from different articles and they write a phrase that way? That's kind of how the Sex Pistols logo looks like. I really dig that one. Some rap artists have excellent logos. Nas, of course, has a very iconic logo. Outkast has a very nice logo. And the Wu-Tang Clan, of course, when the question was asked of me, that was one of the first logos that came to my mind. And although they're not rock bands, but I almost feel like they kind of are. I mean, these are rap groups and artists that transcend the genre. Others that I really like, more classic rock ones, Aerosmith. I'm not a big Aerosmith fan. Always felt they were kind of like a Rolling Stone ripoff. But their classic logo is excellent. So I give even bonus points to a band that I don't like. If they have a logo that I find very cool, you get bonus points. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, kind of like the circle with the letters, iconic logo that you see on t-shirts. Of course, the Grateful Dead have various logos that, you know, always kind of hinting about maybe how their listeners enjoy, you know, some recreational use of drugs. I think their logos are quite cool. The Rolling Stones, the iconic mouth with the licking logo, that's obviously very iconic. Some metal bands have some excellent logos. Metallica, James and Lars, I think, came up with that with the iconic M&A kind of at the back and how it looks. And then it became into Alcolica when they were drinking a lot in the 80s. That's a really cool logo. I love the original Slayer logo. But my personal favorite is Nine Inch Nails logo. I mean, A, they're one of my favorite bands, but I really like how the initials of the band and kind of the reverted N at the end, it looks really, really cool. I've been to a lot of their shows, and when that logo flashes, and in the past it used to be at the end of the show, people go absolutely crazy. Now it's more towards the front. That's the one that really stands out to me. So gun to the head, the two that right when it was asked that stand out to me are Nine Inch Nails and Wu-Tang Clan. So any of our listeners, if I missed any, let us know, and let us know which one's your favorite.
All right, David, last Twitter question of this episode. Is Pearl Jam's 10 one of the best rock albums ever?
So perfect timing for the question, because you and I are going to the show on Tuesday next week here in Boston. I'm going to the first one on Sunday as well. I'm taking my better half. So I have a confession to make. I really like Pearl Jam, but I really like them more as a live act as opposed to their albums. Obviously, 10 is an incredibly iconic album. There's at least four songs that were like huge singles that are really famous. Alive was the song that put them on the map. Jeremy, of course, had a really iconic video. Even Flow, who's a live favorite now. And Black, one of their most famous ballads. So look, 10 is definitely up there. If you said that's the best grunge album, I wouldn't fight you. It's not my favorite, but definitely up there. I'm more of a Versus fan than 10, but I definitely get how when you look at the actual songs that are on 10, and almost all of them were rock radio classics, so I wouldn't fight anyone that says that. So as always, thanks so much to our listeners. Your support is fantastic. We've been getting a ton of reviews on iTunes. If you're listening to us on your iPhone and you have yet to leave us a review, it's such a great way to support the podcast. It takes 2 seconds to give us a 5-star review. Please subscribe to the podcast. Tell your friends. On a side note, I also want to thank everyone's support with The Athletic. I've been writing for them for a while. A lot of people subscribe to read my articles. You've been sending feedbacks to my editors. I'm now going to be covering more and more Serie A on there. This only happens thanks to your support. I think even at The Athletic, they're seeing how Serie A is growing. So thank you to all the people that support Alex's work, my work, and the podcast. So we're going to end the episode with an interview with Andrew Barker. This is going to be a two-parter. Those of you that have been listening to the podcast for a while know that Andrew is a very famous music and movie critic who has a passion for Inter and Serie A. So the first leg is going to be about Inter today. The second leg you'll hear when I'll be on vacation. The second leg is going to be all about movies. We recorded this interview. I think you guys are going to really enjoy it. But let's get to Inter first.
And just before we get to the interview with our good friend Andrew Barker, we just want to remind you that this episode, like every episode, is brought to you by our good friends at Euro Fantasy League, the home of the best Euro fantasy games.
And while last on Monday's episode, we talked about Atalanta, we got some great feedback on that. We are going to shift gears and go to the other Nerazzurri in Serie A with our great friend Andrew Barker. He's been a regular on our podcast. I'm always thrilled when he comes on because that's my cue that we're going to talk a little bit about music and movies as well. But Andrew is one of our go-to people for Inter. He has a deep knowledge of the club. Every time I underrate how much he knows because I respect so much his knowledge on the pop culture stuff. For those of you that aren't familiar with Andrew, he is a senior features writer at Variety in Los Angeles, one of the best movies and music and movie critics in the United States. So, Andrew, I'm thrilled to have you back. Welcome back on Calcioland.
Thanks, David. Quite an introduction there. Try to not disappoint you.
Okay, so Andrew, we're going to be doing a little bit of overreacting and projecting on what's happened at Inter so far.
But you're
pretty reasonable with Inter. So before we get to the projections and overreactions and whatnot, let's pretend that we're recording this before the match against Sassuolo. Let's just pretend that's taking place. Then where would you rank Inter in Serie A without even knowing anything you've seen in the first two matches?
As impossible as that is, I actually don't think my projections would have been all that much different if we'd been recording this 2 weeks ago. We know what happened these last two matches, and it's not great. But I think it's crazy to try to prejudge an entire 38-match season based on the first two matches. And by the same logic, it's just as silly to try to prejudge a season based on the transfer market entirely. But if you had asked me 2 weeks ago, I think my answer would be the same, which is we're looking at hopefully a third or fourth place finish. And I'm hoping just to get to the round of 16 in the Champions League. I think that would be perfectly sort of adequate start for, you know, this kind of new era of Inter finally getting its legs again. I think Inter had the best transfer campaign that we've seen out of them in years. I mean, just really smart, kind of a sober approach, you know, where they're trying to actually fix issues rather than just making sort of signing statements, you know, kind of thing like, oh, okay, we got this guy, this will sell some shirts. We got two really huge players super early on in De Vrij and Asamoah. And then we have these three just incredibly young, incredibly promising attacking players with Politano and Keita Balde and Lautaro Martinez, where, I mean, if just one of them lives up to his potential, it'll be a really smart investment in the three of them. But this is still Inter, and we're still, you know, more than half of this team has like never played in the Champions League before, doesn't really know what that kind of pressure is like. So I definitely never was in that camp thinking that this Inter would be the anti-Juve. I just think that they're so far ahead of us, and Napoli still looks great. They've got Ancelotti. Milan's looking better. Atalanta looks great. So, I mean, I think it's going to be a rough season looking at third, maybe fourth place.
Okay, so now let's get back to real time, what's going on now. So after the loss to Sassuolo, the draw against Torino, Inter canceled the usual day off after the match. They brought in the players for practice. Typically, you know, they always get the day off after a match. Did you find that a bit premature, or do you kind of like this approach, which let's try to get back on track as quickly as possible?
You know, I like it. I think it's exactly what he should have done. You know, there's this kind of culture in the Italian media where whenever anything like this happens, you know, whether it's take away a day off or go on ritiro or have a silenzio stampa or something, like the paper just kind of go nuts and say, okay, this is like, you know, a 4-alarm fire or whatever. But I think it's just good to see Spalletti being proactive about the problems that we saw in those first two matches, because, I mean, just from a spectator's position, it feels like the obvious problem is communication and cohesiveness on the team, with the number of players who were either late transfers or who got kind of back late from the World Cup, hadn't really trained much with their teammates. I mean, they just didn't look like they quite knew what to do all the time. Like, you know, Versalco had a decent enough match last week, but he definitely looked like a player who hadn't trained with his teammates much. Skriniar looked like he wasn't remotely comfortable, like playing as on the left side of a three-man defense. Perisic and Asamoah, both great players, but don't quite look like they're thinking on the same page yet. So what you need in that situation is more time together, not less. I mean, you need to really have these players living with each other. And I don't think it's anything kind of crazy or out of the ordinary. I don't think it's time to panic. Like I said, it's just two matches. But I definitely think that Spalletti recognizes that this match with Bologna has taken on an importance now that it probably wouldn't have had previously. Because, you know, if you pick up a win at Bologna, then you just have this trajectory where you have just a real write-off match at first, and then half a good match in the second one ends up in a draw, and then you have a win. So you're kind of on the up and up there. Whereas if, like, God forbid, we should lose to Bologna or just have a kind of nothing, nil-nil draw, then you're going to see, I think, the press, as we know, really kind of get into overtime. And, you know, the headlines you'll see on Tutto Sport and Corriere will be pretty vicious, I think, if we don't manage to get something here in Bologna. So I think he recognizes the psychological importance of preparing for this match, which otherwise might have just been, you know, kind of workday, match day.
So now let me ask you, I've been thinking about, you know, reasons to be optimistic, and you listed some good ones. You know, the team needs more cohesion, but there are also a couple of reasons for concern that stand out to me. Now, Inter has three Croatian players that play key roles on the team. They had a deep run in the World Cup. So, A, they're probably a little bit more tired than others. And B, although they lost the final, I mean, that tournament was great for them, really showcased their talent. There could be the potential for a slight hangover there. So I want to ask you if that concerns you more than Nainggolan potentially having his best days considerably behind them. Now, Nainggolan, to be fair, has yet to even play for Inter. It looks like he's going to start against Bologna. He's not coming off the best season. There's already, you know, pictures of him in discotheques and whatnot. Of these two things, which concerns you more?
I would say between those, it would be the latter. I'm not that concerned about the sort of Croatian trio and the World Cup hangover because, you know, Brozovic and Perisic each had, I thought, one really excellent half last weekend and then one total crap half, which was pretty much consistent with the entire team, right? So I think they're getting back in there, and Vrsaljko has a lot of, you know, sort of a newcomer jitters to work off. But I don't really see that being such a big problem going forward. I know you're definitely skeptical of Raja and just sort of at this point in his career. And, it is a cause for concern. I mean, Inter made a pretty significant investment in him, knowing his age, knowing his, personal life, you know, whatever you want to say about that. So he's still a very unknown quantity. And I do worry a little bit about sort of what Spalletti might be expecting him to provide once he comes into the team. You know, because when you have a player like that who's been missing, you know, you can kind of look at these problems and think, okay, you know, Nainggolan will fix that. Okay, Nainggolan can play that role. Nainggolan will plug that hole. And if he's not quite ready to do it, then, you know, you start to have real problems. But I mean, you know, like you said, we still haven't seen him play at all. I mean, really all we've seen him do is, like, you know, stare at chicks from the stands, which is very, you know, Raja Nainggolan thing to do. And I will say, though, that previously there was a shot of him in the stands and he was wearing these Air Jordan 1 shattered backboards, which are the orange, white and black shoes, which if you're like a sneaker nerd are like these incredibly rare, just super, super insider shoes. So if nothing else, his sneaker game is still very much on point. So, you know, there's still something going on in his head. I'm hopeful that he can kind of really hit the ground running next weekend.
Okay, well, now I'm sold. I'm adding him to my fantasy team after that. Okay, so now let's talk very briefly about the transfer market. And towards the end of the transfer market, Vidal's been very open about wanting to join Inter, but open to the possibility of joining Inter. It seemed he was on his way out at Bayern. Inter, basically, if they wanted him, they could have signed him. But then, you know, the possibility of signing Luka Modric, unfolded. I definitely think there was something to it. I can see why Inter took the chance to kind of wait and see. And then there was also the issue that Kita Balde was going to take their last non-EU slot. And although Vidal had played in Serie A, if he came back, he would have. So the long and short of it, do you think, as an Inter fan, would you have rather that they just signed Vidal as opposed to go for the Modric dream, which also came with Kita Balde as an added bonus? I know, hindsight is 20/20, but in the moment, or maybe now, what would you have preferred?
The first part of that question is easy, which is, if Inter, in fact, really did pass up an opportunity to sign Vidal for a really reasonable fee and just scuttled that on the off chance that they were going to make this impossible dream of Luka Modric happen, that's a pretty silly move, I think. And I think it's kind of would be the one sort of black eye in this otherwise really, really smart transfer market. Because, I mean, I know that I saw the Marzio reporting and then people I trust obviously reporting that this was a real thing, the Modric pursuit, but they had to know the chances of that happening were pretty unlikely, right? So the idea of getting a player like Vidal, who really would have been incredibly welcome here, and giving that up for this long shot opportunity doesn't seem very smart to me. But I will say, actually, you know, I think I'm probably unique among Inter fans in that I'm actually much more excited about Kita Balde than even Lautaro Martinez. You remember him at Lazio. He was just incredible.
He's one of my favorites. Talent.
Yeah, no, he's great. I don't think France was maybe necessarily the best move for him, but he's still incredibly young, still just so sharp. And I was thrilled that we got him. So I think it could maybe end up working out for the best. I do think another thing that kind of another question that's still in my mind is, you know, it's weird that, you know, Spalletti has, you know, both times we've seen Kita Balde play, he's played kind of in a trequartista position. And I know that he also played Lautaro there in the first match. And so clearly that's kind of a role that he wants. And I don't know if either of those players are necessarily the best fit there. I don't know if he's expecting Rajan Angolan to come in and really be that kind of a whole player. But I look at that and I just think about how strange it is that we let Rafinha just slip away. I mean, if we were willing to pay the kind of money it would have taken to bring in a Vidal or, you know, a Modric to the club, clearly we could have afforded Rafinha. Clearly he plays in exactly that place that Spalletti is experimenting with, maybe not so perfect players. And so, if we're willing to kind of go all in for a Vidal, and we know Rafinha works on this team, I'm kind of confused as to why we didn't make that happen. But I'm, you know, however it shook out, I'm really happy to have Kita Balde on the team, and I'm looking forward to him starting and really getting back into the groove he had in Serie A previously.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say about Modric is, you know, I was skeptical and all along, but I knew there was definitely something there. But I did get pretty excited when they did the Instagram thing with the picture, you're missing it and the like. That was pretty cool. At that moment, I was like, ooh, I better get ready. Something might be happening. So speaking of Modric, you know, there's been a lot of talk that maybe what Inter's lacking is like a regista type. And, you know, the thing with that is not necessarily every club has a regista. I've seen plenty of like teams that won a lot that didn't really have the classic type player. But do you think that is something that really is lacking on Inter? Do you see that as an issue? I mean, from where I see it, I think creativity can come from a lot of different areas. I think they're really strong on the wings. Do you think that's enough, or would you have liked ideally like someone that has those qualities?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, maybe you disagree, but I think Brozovic has proven that he can play in that
position.
Yeah,
I agree, actually.
Yeah, I think he just needs a better partner there. I think one of the real shortcomings of Inter so far has been the Vecino role. I think he's still a very valuable player to have on the team. I just don't see him working with Brozovic like he should, that would allow Brozovic to play in that sort of regista role. Gallardini didn't have the greatest season last season, but I do think he provides a lot more defensive cover than Vecino does. So I'm kind of curious why Spalletti doesn't seem interested in having him there. But then once again, that also might be where he's expecting Nainggolan to really step up and just be that pit bull in the midfield, picking up the ball so that Brozovic can, you know, have a little more time on the ball to dictate things.
Yeah, I totally agree on the Brozovic thing, too. I mean, on Croatia, he was playing with Modric and Rakitic, a little bit of a drop-off at Inter, but I think in due time it can work out there. And we have to see, you know, with Nainggolan, and let's see if Asamoah, can play a little bit more in the midfield. So now, this is completely hypothetical, and I was asked about, you know, if Conte would be a better fit on Inter or Milan, and now, of course, we have all the controversy with Mourinho at Manchester United. So this is completely premature, but this is a total hypothetical, at least for now. If you had to pick, if God forbid things go really south with Spalletti, if you could have either Mourinho come back or Conte arrive, which one of the two would you prefer?
You know, you didn't leave a Simeone option, which ruins what I was going to say. When is that going to happen, by the way? Like, I feel like Inter fans have been 100% certain that Simeone is going to arrive anytime now, and that's been like 5 years. But, I mean, you know, we've already got two of his ex-players now, and Icardi would be like a perfect Cholo-style striker. But since you didn't ask about that, I don't know, man. With Mourinho, I mean, any Inter fan who lived through the treble year will always adore Mourinho and will always have this real soft spot for him. But he just... I don't think he's been the same since Madrid, you know, like I feel like something personally happened with him there where things just went a little dark. And it's like we've since been watching him. That was the turning point. And now he's kind of gone from the arrogant young genius into the kind of the bitter old crank, you know, right in front of our eyes. Like, and I mean, he's obviously still a great coach because, I mean, he's still winning like the odd Premiership or Europa League. But I think his style feels like it's kind of falling out of fashion. And the thing about like the old Mourinho was that, you know, he was a jerk. He was a complete jerk, but he knew how to harness that jerkiness for maximum strategic effectiveness, you know, like at Inter and at his first time at Chelsea, like he was this genius for creating these sort of siege moments where this real us against the world kind of feeling for his players and for the fans. And he was great at using the media to like wage psychological warfare against, you know, the other coaches and to build this narrative. And so even when he was saying like ridiculous, insulting and regrettable stuff, it felt like he was doing it for a reason. And now it just kind of feels like he's just this tired, aging man who's like at war with his own players, who's just like yelling at the reporters in a way that doesn't help him at all. It's kind of like when you see like old punk rockers, like no one turns from like this sort of radical revolutionary into this sort of just sour old man faster than like a punk rocker. And Jose was like, he was like a punk manager when he started off. And now he's just kind of this irritable old crank, you know, sitting in the coffee shop yelling at the kids. So I don't think he would work at Inter again, as much as it pains me to say that. And Conte, I mean, I don't know, like he's a great coach, but I mean, can you imagine as a player just waking up every morning knowing you have to go and let this guy yell at you every single day? I think I don't know how he would fare with our current players. I don't know if he'd get the best out of them.
My answer is neither. Yeah, no, and I think Simeone was a great way out not to answer the question. That's why I didn't put it. But I talked about it on a Monday. I don't see Conte as – there's too many expectations at Inter. He does well with no expectations, and basically overachieving what he has and at Inter is not a good formula. So let's end this part, the first round of our interview, with this question. And Andrew's obviously a music expert, and once in a while I chat with him on 90s rock, which is my favorite. And one band that we talked about a few times is the Smashing Pumpkins. And Andrew has a great analogy for them that, you know, I know you've listened to them your whole life, kind of like I have. And, you know, 70% of the time, they're really frustrating. But the 30% of the time that it works, it's really pretty amazing. So with that in mind, I've been trying to think, you know, what kind of is the equivalent and calcio of that. And I came up with Antonio Cassano as being calcio's version of Billy Corgan. Do you think I'm on track, or do you kind of see it differently?
I think you're totally right with the whole 70-30 idea, where he's just like totally agonizing you until he does something absolutely brilliant that no one else would ever do. I just don't think that Cassano is like a Billy Corgan personality. You know, I think Cassano is basically the Kanye of calcio. You know, like he's Cassano's not like kind of dour and sullen and depressive, you know, like Billy Corgan is. Like his problem is he's actually like too ebullient and cheerful, and he's got this like narcissistic devil may care attitude that's actually really charming and entertaining until all of a sudden it's not. Until all of a sudden it becomes this like insane self-sabotage, and he's like too far in his own world to notice people waving like, no, Cassano, stop, you know, too far, which is definitely a Kanye West kind of thing. So I don't know. It's tough trying to think of someone with Billy Corgan's disposition, like, because you got to kind of think that, you know, it's just this sort of dark, irritable personality, like an inability to get along with anyone else for an extended period of time. And then this having an incredible amount of talent while still consistently overestimating the vastness of your own talent. So I'm thinking more like a Bobo Vieri, you know, like the way he could nothing ever worked out well for long enough with Bobo Vieri. And you always knew what he was capable of, but he's just too much of a jerk to have everything work out. So that's my pick.
Awesome. Okay, so this was round one of our interview. We covered mainly calcio. It was great. Andrew has always brought it with Inter. And on part two, which you'll hear in a couple of weeks, when I'll be on vacation in Italy, we're going to chat about movies. So when you listen to part two, just envision me in Italy, just eating as much as possible. So Andrew, as always, thank you so much for joining us to chat about Inter. It was a real pleasure.
Of course.